Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
Hello and welcome to the IGN UK podcast. My name is Simon Cardy and I've got a very bad cold. I'm joined by Matt Perslow.
Hello, also known as Dale Driver.
I was really hoping Jesse would answer when I said that. And Jesse Gomez.
I'm just me. I like to be me, so yeah. I'm going to stick it like that.
If you do hear the other two calling me Joe all the way through, that's just a fun nickname that we've got for me. me, Simon Cardy, the guy who likes football and lies. this week, we are going to talk about a few games that we've been playing, but also at the end of the episode, so as not to spoil anyone, we're going to have a discussion about Loki with full spoilers up to the end of episode 4, because we haven't touched on Loki for a little while, and y'all know that we like, well, Marvel and that. But before that, Jesse, you and I have both played a bit of Sea of Thieves, A Pirate's Life.
Yes.
Which is, it sounds like it should be an oxymoron, because yeah, it was already a game about a pirate's life.
That basically just sounds like the subtitle for the actual game.
Yeah, but it is the Pirates of the Caribbean crossover that was announced and released, what, like nine days after announcement, or maybe even less?
Yeah, like it came out really recently, didn't it? Like
I don't know where I've got the 9 days from. Maybe it was really quick, but it came out on it came out earlier or late last month.
It was pretty soon.
How are you finding it? What have you done?
So I'm, like, just to preface, like, I'm fairly new to Sea of Thieves. Our whole, like, my partner and I have been playing it, and like the core game, we found it to be really, really fun. We played a game kind of similar to it, Raft, and we're just in the mood for another co-op kind of sea-based venture. So we jumped on Sea of Thieves, and we've been enjoying it. But we joined a few of her mates from work to play the first Tall Tales of A Pirate's Life. And like, we were really, really excited, but what we played so far kind of left us feeling a little bit flat, and that's probably just because it's the first episode and we haven't got fully into it, and we expected it to be linear, which it is, but we also expected it to be fun as well, which it kind of isn't.
Have you done any of the other Tall Tales, like the original Tall Tales?
Like, we played maybe like 3 hours of just normal Sea of Thieves, just to get to understand how the game works and stuff, and we did feel like little, just, you know, simple missions or whatever, but like no big campaign stuff as of yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know, the trailer really sold me on this idea of A Pirate's Life, and then just played it and I just, it's just okay.
Well, you know? I think so I've played a lot of Sea of Thieves, specifically the main campaign, like the main Tall Tales, or the original Tall Tales, I should say, and I've done more or less as much as you have on A Pirate's Life. So the first mission, which is essentially like, go and find Jack Sparrow. You end up in the world of the dead. But what it also is, because so this is the interesting thing, I think, as a game, bit of like something to play with, that first mission, I think you're right, there's not much to it.
Yeah.
But as someone who really likes the original Pirates of the Caribbean ride, it is a really weird and interesting take on that thing. Like,
yeah,
there are elements from it that are straight out of the Disney ride, including the actual VO. Like,
yeah, it felt like we were on a ride, because there's this kind of part where you're, you know, slowly getting towards Jack Sparrow and stuff, and you're going through these like series of caves, and it's like, stop here and listen to this little bit of the story, and you have like maybe a little song playing in the background, and it felt like you were on the ride for, well, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean or whatever, but obviously you're in a game.
Yeah, but I think, yeah, that's the thing, is kind of, I don't think you need to worry too much. I'm fairly sure the rest of those things will be proper Sea of Thieves missions, because the Tall Tales in that game, mostly, I'd say there's one or two slight duds, usually based around combat, but like the puzzle stuff in the Tall Tales previously was amazing, and if they've got that right again, then I'm all in. for a bit more of this, but with Jack Sparrow on my ship.
Also, presumably that first mission is a bit of an onboarding exercise, because there'll be like probably thousands of people that download this on Games Pass who have never touched Sea of Thieves before, but are super interested in Pirates of the Caribbean.
It is interesting. Like, it's not quite a tutorial, because I think when you join for the first time, it will still make you do the maiden voyage mission thing. But I'm sure there is a certain amount of just like, we're going to teach you how to get from here to here. That said, Jesse, to explain, this mission is essentially you go to a place, you see what amounts to a cutscene, and then you end up on an island where you do a little platforming puzzle, and then there's sort of a miniature open world where you have to do a puzzle.
Yeah.
Did you do any of the secret puzzles in there?
No, so we ended up kind of flubbing it, because like when it comes to when I play these kind of games, I like to kind of, you know, just, it's the same kind of Skyrim thing. You don't want to go through the door, you want to try and climb over the rock to get to a place. So you start like fucking around with the boundaries of the game and messing about to try and complete an objective early. So we ended up like bugging one of the missions, I guess, because one of them requires you to get a pirate skull back to his body. We ended up doing it in this like half-assed way where we kind of broke the game a little bit. So maybe that messed up our expectations a little
So the secret puzzle stuff is genuinely quite good in there. So I did the mission a bit pissed with friends the first time. We just went through it and did it quickly. And then I did it by myself and went back and like 100%ed it, for one of
the better term.
And like some of that puzzle is really satisfying. Like there's treasure to find and secrets to get to. And it leads to a final thing, which went around the internet yesterday by coincidence, which I hadn't spoken to anyone about, and I'm not going to spoil here. It's a really good little Easter egg.
Okay, yeah. So I've seen what it is. Yeah.
And like when I found that, I was like, oh, this is a really cool thing. Like this is a really good reward for doing all this work. Because you can stay there for like maybe an hour extra to doing all this stuff.
That's like we were goofing about and stuff, but when it came to the core game, my partner and I, like, we did this little mission where, you know, we were reading off, we had to find a specific chest, and we had like a bunch of riddles to find specific places, and that was really, really fun. And I hope, you know, they bring that, like, the core experience of Sea of Thieves from what I've played so far hasn't translated to, you know, the first kind of, like you said, onboarded mission of a pirate's life. But that, again, it is just the first mission. But obviously, you're there to get Jack Sparrow. What do you think of Jack Sparrow? Like, what are your thoughts of just having him in the game?
I mean, I'm not a fan of Johnny Depp, and I wish it could be someone who wasn't Jack Sparrow. I think what's super interesting is, like, it feels like what Disney specifically is trying to do is to distance Jack Sparrow from Johnny Depp. Like, it's a different voice actor, and they're just going like, he's the guy from the ride and the films. He is not the actor we are trying not to associate with that man. I'm not sure that's possible.
Well, because they said, I remember in one of their like featurettes, like, we got, you know, one of Johnny Depp's like stuntmen who like perfectly encapsulated like his form in the game and stuff. But even when he's in the game, I remember watching those trailers and saying, oh, you know, he's going to fight alongside you and stuff. And in that first mission, he is there fighting with you, but it is like, he is very much a scripted character. He's not like an NPC who's like, fighting against AI with you.
Later on, he definitely is a guy on your boat who does stuff.
And will
like shout out like, you're low on cannonballs or whatever. You know, like he'll become a part of, they've intended him to be an AI member of the crew.
There's just one part specifically where like,
he's having a fight with a big crab.
Yeah. And he like, we can all stop like fighting our AI and just watch him. And it is an animation that repeats. You can see that cycle until you progress enough for him to, you know, whatever ends up happening next for him.
Like it's watching stuff like, that bit, I was just like, come on, mate.
Yeah, it's a little bit.
I've just killed three of those crabs at the same time it's taken you, and you're meant to be like the greatest pirate in history.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I genuinely am excited to play more. So I play Sea of Thieves very, very slowly because it always involves getting the same other three people together, and we're probably all a bit useless.
Yeah,
but I kind of enjoy the fact that it's something that I dip back into over and over again. So I'm looking forward to picking through it. I'm glad, like, they did those tall tales a long time ago and they hadn't added to them very much. And they're really my favorite part of Sea of Thieves. Like, I love how they build in, like, if you go and play some of those other tall tales, you'll see like the way they roll all their stuff together, like use the world and hide secrets within it. And like, you know, finding a place that you, an island you've been to a dozen times, and then finding out there's a secret wall on it that leads to a vault and stuff. And you're like, this is so fucking cool.
Like, no, it does seem, it seems like a really, really fun game. What I played so far, I've really enjoyed. And like I said, I've only played the first, you know, tall tale of a pirate's life. So I'm looking forward to more of it. It's just that that tutorial mission was a bit too scripted for me, I guess. But, you know, it is meant to introduce people to the DLC. So I understand.
Yeah. Matt, have you played much Sea of Thieves?
So I played it when it first came out and really adored it. Like, I think we had this mentioned before. It reminded me a lot of kind of like that kid idea of like sitting in a box, which is your pirate ship. I've got it installed. I'm currently playing through with someone all of the Halo games because we're trying to get all of Halo done before Infinite comes out. But we've both got that installed with the intention of the, we'll do the Pirates of the Caribbean stuff, but then actually catch up on all of these updates of Sea of Thieves that I haven't seen because I've not played it since the months it launched in.
Oh, it's... it's so much bigger. And like, I would say this to a lot of people who tried Sea of Thieves early on, like, this, it's so much bigger now. Like, I came to it, what, last year is when I really got back into it. And just the amount of stuff there is to do and the amount of stuff they've kind of finessing they've done to it is really nice. Like, down to the fact that, like, you've got harpoons on the ships now that make it easier to get around as well as do, you know, do other stuff. Like, it's really, really cool.
I didn't even realize just how beautiful the game is. Like,
the sea is incredible.
I want to drink it.
Yeah, it looks the sea so is, good. The sea is a joke how good it looks. Like, yeah. I really like that what they, the kind of style of it is, like, they've gone, we've got like this kind of cartoon aesthetic and that like seemingly relatively lowering what you need the game to run at has allowed them to make like the best looking sea in games of all time. Like, it's such a cool thing.
It's also like crazy. That style is a massive nostalgia thing for me because it's got a bit of Monkey Island to it. That sort of like the stylized clouds and the really chunky kind of bits that remind me a lot of kind of when, you know, when they did the special edition versions of Monkey Island, which had that weirdly chunky cartoon art style. It's got a lot of that to it. And obviously its sense of humor is very much in that lineage.
Yeah, and like run-down Spanish colonial architecture and stuff. Like, it just looks really, it's very good. Oh, just a good game. Matt, you haven't been playing Sea of Thieves. You've got something called Wildermyth?
Wildermyth, yeah.
What the hell is Wildermyth?
This is, so it's only recently come out in full. I think it was an early access game for a while, but it's now, a bit like Grifflands was kind of like a few weeks back, has been in early access for a while, is now a full thing. It's basically Dungeons and Dragons XCOM, I think, is the easiest way to explain it.
Okay.
So it's got a series of pre-written campaigns in it, a bit like what you would if you were a dungeon master running a D&D tabletop campaign. And so they're all kind of made up of much shorter sort of chapters that create these little, almost like anthology of stories, really. And so you start at the beginning in the first one with just a set of pre like created characters, like they're randomly generated like an XCOM crew would be. And as you play through these stories and these campaigns, it's about building like a legend and like a team that ages and dies and is reborn and stuff like this over hours and hours of play. So it's a bit difficult to, because a bit like how Grifflands is kind of like, it's an RPG, but it's also a roguelike, but it's also a deck builder. It's got a lot of that. It's many things at once. So kind of like the combat scenarios in it are very, very XCOM. It's grid-based. You're moving characters around. They have individual abilities based on what kind of class they are. So it's very simple in that it's got wizards, sort of warriors and hunters, basically. But they can sort of branch out and become lots of different things over the course of your playthrough. That is then, those combat encounters come as part of like an overworld map where you're working your way through different regions. So you send characters into different regions, they search for things, and that might be, you found a tower in this region and now you're going to go into the tower in the combat scenario, work your way up to the top, and hopefully there'll be something there that you can find. As you're doing that, you'll come across these things that you find, and then you get the more story-based kind of scenarios where it's done a bit like, you know, kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure kind of almost visual novel style, where you get a kind of lots of comic book panels which puts your characters that you've kind of had randomly generated that you've been building over time into those comic book panels, and it kind of factors in also the personalities that you've built. So you might have a couple that eventually fall in love. Like, you might have two party members that have fallen in love, and they'll have different dialogue depending on what their relationships are. And all of those are kind of built through these kind of choose your own adventure things. So generally you'll have three choices of what you want to do, and it will give you just kind of a rough idea, like, this will increase romance between these characters, this will increase rivalry between these two characters. So as the story's building, it's factoring in kind of like the personalities that you've got. But one of my favorite things that's happened so far in my run, which I'm not all that far into, but did a big kind of boss combat encounter area, found a like a gemstone in a rock, and was like, that looks interesting, I'll try and take that. Tried to wrench it out the rock. That went kind of wrong. It fired out of the rock into one of my character's eye. So he now has a gemstone for an eye. But at the end of that first chapter of the campaign, based on how well you do through it, you get like so many years of peace, where you then get, you know how kind of like at the end of a Mass Effect game or something like that, you'd have like, here's what's happened based on all the decisions you've just made. It kind of does that for the bits in between the campaign chapters, where it's like, because you managed to save all of these places and you made these decisions, you've now got 9 years of peace. And this is what happened in those 9 years. Well, the guy that I had a gemstone lodged in his eye, the gems have now taken over his body, and he's now become a gemstone man. And like, his arm has turned into a giant gemstone sword, and he's got like an arm that's a gemstone shield.
So that doesn't sound too bad.
But so what, how many people will have that event happen to them? Like, is that built into the story of that campaign?
I think the gemstone exists in that storyline, and it's what you decide to do with it. Like, if you decided not to risk it, you might not, you obviously wouldn't have any of that at all. If you decided not to go to that area, you wouldn't have that at all. And I guess there might be a role on how successful you are digging the gemstone out of the rock. Having only played like that section through once, I don't know, but I know a lot of it is because it's got that XCOM lineage, is about kind of like the randomization about things. So yeah, you might not have your gemstone man, who now has completely different stats and abilities from what he had before. So I've lost my archer, but I've now got a man made of gemstones that can stab people with his fingers.
From what you've played so far, how in-depth does the character stuff go? Like, because you said you can alter their relationships or like make people hate each other or something within your squad. Like,
So I had a pair that were in love. She died, unfortunately. But when you have deaths in combat, you get like choices on how they go out. So they can either go out in like a blaze of glory, where they'll deal 10 damage to kind of like the things that attack them, which might kill them, and then mean that you've got a chance for everybody else to stay alive. You can have them go down in like a massive speech where they'll give everybody extra armor and buffs as they go down. Or you can, if they're a real favorite of yours, you can have them just severely maimed and they run away. But like, then if they do die, you get the choice of, do you bury them and you build a tomb to them and you kind of add them to your legend, or do you just bury them kind of in a nameless grave and just let kind of like the past be the past? I don't
really
know
cool.
what happens if they get added to your legend, but I have a feeling from what I've read around it, you might be able to have them like resurrected as heroes in other lives kind of further as the campaigns go.
Oh, okay. So like the potential chance of these, what you said, heroes, right? Like potentially coming back in other stories?
Yeah, if you see kind of like, if you look through the screenshots of it on Steam, there's lots of like, you see people with like giant wings and kind of very angelic things. And my wondering is it a case of like when you add them to your legend, where they basically get put on like the home screen, like when you're loading a game, they're around a campfire. So I'm wondering kind of like, it says that there's a way that those legends get factored back into your game. My assumption is that they can come back as like deities or like legends in their own right.
Yes, please. Yeah.
So that's very cool. And then you also have like this weird kind of like spin on the Nemesis system in it.
Here we go.
There we go.
I had already bought and started installing this as you spoke, but now I'm extra in.
It's got what are called calamities, which are basically like your enemies learn like as battles go by, and I don't think it's based on kind of what you necessarily do to them, but it's like if you complete a battle, like the enemies disperse and then they get a new card added to like this deck system, which is called the Calamities deck, And so it might be a case of if you face kind of like these demons over and over again, they learn that it's kind of like, okay, now when you kill us, we're going to just summon in another one. Or now when they come to the battle, they're always going to have plus 25% health. And yeah. you have these legend points, which you can use to mitigate that, which I've not used yet because I still haven't got a full grasp on the games and I don't want to waste a very precious resource. Mm. But it's like, if you see at the end of kind of like a combat encounter, it's like, okay, these enemies that you just fought, now the next time you face them, we're putting this card in the deck. And it's a case of they're going to have like extra four armor that you'll have to burn through. Mm-hmm. You can spend a point that you've accrued to make sure that that card doesn't go into their deck, and you can sort of mitigate that. But obviously over time, enemies are changing and warping in the same way that how in the Nemesis system, you'll have individual characters are warping. And it's not as... it's obviously not the Nemesis system because it's not based on the relationship that you have with a specific enemy, but it is based on the idea as time goes, enemies aren't the same. They change and they reflect kind of like the state of the world.
Okay.
And as you're going around to different towns and areas on the map, you can kind of lay down like defenses and stuff like that. You can say, for now, I'm going to spend like 30 days in this area building up defenses. But there's a counter at the top that's like, in 25 days, we're going to
hit a big event that's going to
happen. There's going to be an event where kind of things will start pillaging the world, and also new Calamity Guards will get played into it. So there's a timing sort of system, which is very XCOM in the way that you're always against a sort of clock.
Mm. Right.
So yeah, when you sit down and say all that, you realize there's a fucking shed load going on in this video game, but the way that it pulls it all together makes a lot of sense. And does have this feeling where you are sort of in control of the destinies of these people that you recruit, in the same way that XCOM very makes you feel like you're in control. You do build up kind of fondness for your characters, and whilst they are randomly generated, you have that XCOM thing. Like, you can give them names if you want. All of their equipment that you can sort of create for them, you can sort of decide if you've kind of got a myth that you like going on and you want to name a sword after that, and it's like, oh, it's in honor of this other character, you can do that, and you can kind of build really up cool. your own universe around it.
Did you say that characters age?
Yeah.
As well?
Yeah, they get older.
So throughout the campaign,
gems.
That is very cool. But what, like, would a campaign be over the course of 50 years or something?
I think that's the idea. Yeah, you could, so as I say, like at the end of kind of like the first chapter, depending on how well you do, it's like, you know, I got 9 years of peace, and so my characters have aged by 9 years, and that obviously doesn't create a lot of visual difference in them at the moment, but yeah. I've seen how the characters can become old people and I guess have to retire. You can also have children based on the romances system, so okay. That's a little bit like, did any of you play Massive Chalice?
Yeah.
No.
Massive Chalice was a Double Fine game, which was basically just XCOM set in fantasy world, but that had this idea of you got a house that had a lineage, and you'd be able to kind of have like the key characters in it would be able to have children, which I suppose probably that was probably nicked from Fire Emblem, right, Joe?
I'm not sure it was nicked so much. Like, Fire Emblem Awakening did that to a certain extent, but that was more built... that was more like a story event.
Sure.
Like, halfway through that game, characters who had significant relationships would have offspring, but it wasn't super generative. Like, Massive Chalice, I didn't like for a few reasons, but I thought the offspring stuff was very cool, and it actually felt closer to me to something like Medieval Total War, where you were, like, building up or Crusader Kings, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like a bit more grand strategy type feeling of
sending
like
your 15-year-old son to the battlefield.
Well, like, yeah, like, and manipulating, like there is something. I often struggle to think of a better term for it, and it is a gross term, but it is basically like gaming eugenics.
Yeah,
like where you're kind of like sitting there and going like, how can I genetically engineer the best offspring? Or in the case of Medieval Total War 1, where I played an entire game where I tried to make the worst king of all time, and I would like breed all my idiots together to create like this perfect cocktail of alcoholism, meanness, bad at fighting, and then see if I could run the kingdom. But yeah, like, so I guess it has, yeah, I guess it has some of that. Like, and I there's something that I find very, very interesting about a game that like tells a story beyond one life. I always like that thing. So yeah, Wildermyth sounds right up my street.
Yeah.
It sounds cool.
Yeah, and it's like, it's obviously it's only on PC, and I imagine it probably won't ever make the jump. It's made by a very small studio, but it's also got like a papercraft kind of art style to it. It's very kind of, basically, if you've just got the shittiest laptop, I imagine it will run on that. Like, there's not a lot going on. It's a lot of static images, and the battles have nice kind of effects in them, but they are very much like, it's designed to look like a bunch of people painted these kind of enemies, cut them out of little cardboard, and even the way they move around the battle, it's like, you know when you move your chess pieces and you lift them from one square to the next, that's how they move across the battlefield.
It looks a little bit like, what is it, Don't Starve?
I know what you mean, yeah.
It's definitely kind of like within... actually, now I think about it, the way that your character moves in Don't Starve has got that very kind of almost like he's been moved like a player
piece.
Yeah,
like I just hop around. Yeah. Well, I've got it installed right now.
So do I. You've sold me on it. You know, part of the reason you sold me on it, and this is a great segue, is because I recently finally finished Inkle's Sorcery series.
Oh, okay.
I talk every time Inkle releases something, I talk about it on this podcast because I am in love with Inkle games. They are the best. But for some reason, and I looked back, Sorcery 4 came out in 2016, which is ridiculous. But so if you don't know, Sorcery, the series is a four-part series based on a four-part series of Choose Your Own Adventure books from the 80s. I think they're technically fighting fantasy and aren't allowed to be called Choose Your Own Adventure because that is a trademarked thing. But they were Inkle's first big project, to my knowledge, and they got progressively more and more brilliant as they went through. So, like, the first one is a pretty faithful adaptation of the first Sorcery book, which is you're an adventurer, you're trying to go and kill the evil archmage, and you walk through a bit of countryside and you make a bunch of decisions and you have a few fights. They invented a fighting game system, which was like, it's kind of odd. It's almost like betting how much energy you're going to spend on attack versus the AI, which is kind of fun. And it has this spell casting system where if you bring, you can choose not to bring a spell book, which would be completely insane. But you cast spells by typing in 3-letter words. And whenever there's a chance to cast a spell, you like look up into the stars and it gives you all the possible spells you could cast, but you have to work out what those spells are. So it's like, I'm in a situation where there's like an evil rat that's going to come and bite me. I could cast Hot, which casts a fireball and just blow it up, or I could cast Six, which creates 5 duplicates of me, and then the rat doesn't know how to do it. And it like, it has
that's
so
really cool.
Yeah, and it has so many variations of this stuff. It is like wildly overwritten. It's amazing. Overwritten
in
the best
possible. Is it a difficult game to play?
No, not at all. Like it's basically just like a text adventure with a graphic representation of what's going on.
I like the sound of that.
But that's Sorcery 1. As they go through, the level of ambition that Inkle starts putting in, and you can see Inkle growing as a company over these four games, because the first one's like, here's a choose your own adventure with some graphic stuff that we've come up with. The second one's kind of similar, but it has this time travel gimmick where you get to the end of the game, and if you haven't done enough, you can go back to the start of a certain area and do things differently to get more information to do better at the end.
That's cool.
And also, these are all one story, so everything you do has real, actual, proper effects on everything else that comes later, including your inventory, your maximum health, right down to decisions you've made, like with individual characters. Then Sorcery 3 has this fucking wild thing where there are these lighthouses across the world, and you can move the light beams, and the beacons cause swathes of the land to change what time they're in. So you're in like a post-apocalyptic version of this area, and when you cast light over these swathes of areas, it goes back to when this was like a lush, verdant place with towns and people and stuff. And so there's essentially two completely different maps that interact with each other. At the same time, you're being chased by 7 evil serpents who can appear all over the map and have their own individual puzzles with how to defeat them. You don't have to fight any of them, and you could leave, but it would fuck everything up in Sorcery 4, which is a whole other thing. Oh my god, it's the most like wild like growing series.
So everything is connected from game to game.
Yeah, and this is why when I went to finish Sorcery 4, I went, I'm not going to just do the end of Sorcery 4. I'm going to start at Sorcery 1 and play all the way through again so that I actually remember what the fuck has been going on.
That's mad.
And Sorcery 4 is like a really interesting way of tying all this stuff together, because it introduces... Sorcery 3 introduces this new idea that it barely uses, which is counter spells. And you find out that every spell you've had has an opposite spell that can make it disappear. And in Sorcery 4, that becomes like a huge part of how to solve the game. And you don't know that that's going to happen. So you start learning this entire new mechanic right at the end of the game. Then it also has the choose your own adventure thing of, you know, when you're playing a choose your own adventure, you stick your finger in a page so that you can turn back to it if you don't like. That's literally a mechanic in the game. Like, you can rewind any decision. In Sorcery 4, once you get to a certain point, it's like, evil magic stops you from doing this anymore. There is no more rewinding. So suddenly you feel like this huge part of how you've played the game has been ripped away from you. And it's just, it's incredibly smart. And I went looking and I was like, I absolutely love this, and I can't believe it didn't get talked about more. And then I looked back in 2016 and noticed all these like very good games journalists being like, this might be the best RPG video game ever made. Like, and the more I think about it, the more I'm like, I think they might be right. Like, the amount to which your choices matter, and this is why Wildermyth sounds so good, because it feels like it directly reflects tiny decisions as well as big ones.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that what amounts to a text adventure game, in I think Sorcery 1 or 2, I picked up an item that I used for the first time in Sorcery 4. Like, that's bonkers. The level of thinking that involves to do that over the course of years of developing a series is like just so cool. And it just makes you feel like any RPG, any role-playing game, should be communicating the idea that this is your story, not the story being told to you. And Sorcery does that better than most things. And I think Inkle have gone on to do incredible stuff. I think Heaven's Vault is another one of those games, and I will never stop talking about Heaven's Vault. But something like 80 Days is actually a very different thing. It's more about like puzzling and thought and skill. Whereas this really is an RPG in the old sense of the word. Like, you are part of a story, and you are getting to tell it. And I think it's absolutely amazing. And it also taught me that Android or Google Play Store has its own subscription service like Apple Arcade that I didn't know existed.
Really?
Called Google Play Pass. Huh. You pay £5 a month. I just downloaded all of those. I got Chuchul, which I hadn't played before. That's really fun. Yeah. I've got like a load of games I didn't realise it even existed. So it's fucking brilliant, man.
Just looking now, the complete Sorcery collection until the 8th of July is 55% off. So you can basically get these games for under £11, all of them.
I genuinely think it's best on mobile. Like, I don't know what it'd be like to play on PC, because it feels very... It's got a really satisfying thing of... do you remember when Disco Elysium came out and they said they created the way the text moved to reflect social media? Like, that's how people read stuff now. It has that, where it's like your phone is putting together the story, and the story literally looks like it's been stitched. Each bit of text is stitched to the last bit, like someone's creating this like scrolling tapestry of everything you've done. And so I think it really gets across the idea of what they're going for on mobile. That's not to say don't play on PC. I'm sure it's amazing.
Did it come out on mobile first then?
I think it was like an iOS game. I might be wrong. Maybe it came out on PC at the same time, but I've always played it as a mobile game.
I mean, it sounds reassuring that like the mobile experience is, you know, is good.
It's fantastic. Yeah. It's such a good game. I can't speak highly enough of it. And Inkle are just the best. Right. That's it for this bit. We're going to talk about Loki at the end, but full spoilers. So before we get to that, I believe Matt has something called an endless search. Inside, it's a UK IGN crew. Yeah, and the ones and twos. We got the games gonna play for you. Inside, I got a question for you. Hold tight, the DJ, we're coming through. Yeah, and the ones and twos. We got the games gonna play for you. Inside, I got a question for you. Is it in the search?
Right then, boys. I listened to last week's podcast, and you seem to have a good time with the listener submission.
Remind me.
Which was...
it was the movie one, isn't it?
It was the finding the lowest Rotten Tomato score.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
So I thought we'd try and do a remix on that, mm-hmm. bring it into the world of games, bring it into the world of Metacritic. So it's essentially the same rules. You'll have a category, but you'll be looking for a game this time. And we're trying to find the lowest score on Metacritic.
Into it.
If you find it, a score that's under 50, I'll give you a bonus point.
Under 50?
It's very difficult in games to get under 50.
Really?
Yeah, it's because of all those 8 out of 10s exactly. IGN gives, guys.
Unbelievable.
So, since we know how the game works, I'm looking for games that were exclusively released on a PlayStation console.
Oh, that's good. People like those games.
Exactly.
Really bad. PlayStation but exclusives.
There is a trove of real shit PlayStation exclusives. Yeah.
It has to be something like generation wide.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So you can go from the first PlayStation right up to the fifth one. So
I feel like the PS3 must have really shit.
That's what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm.
Or like the PSP and stuff.
Yeah. So hold it in until you've both got an answer and then let me know.
I've got one.
Right.
I'll wait till
Joe, you look like you've entered your mind palace.
I have, and it's completely empty in there.
I saw a documentary on this game and how it was super shit. So that's why it's clear in my head.
We've really hit Jesse's niche, which is bollocks.
It's true. Like I like
really
these stories.
Oh, no. I don't know any games.
You must have reviewed something that is like complete dog shit.
But I've never been a PlayStation exclusive reviewer.
Right.
So I was much less exposed to the rubbish. I'm going to just go... Oh, no. Oh, shit. Am I going first?
Yeah, go on then, Joe. Go first.
Oh, Christ.
I can go first if that will
No. What's the Killzone PSP game? I'm sure it got actually
Killzone
rated
Liberation.
Really well.
It is.
Is that one people thought was actually good?
Let's have a look.
I got around to playing that.
Killzone Liberation, released 2006 exclusively on the PlayStation Portable. 77 Metascore in the green. Jesse.
It's time for the Halo killer, Haze.
I knew you'd fucking choose, and I'd looked up Haze when I was starting this game.
Was that PlayStation exclusive?
It was. It was on the PlayStation 3. And
I think, wasn't that Ubisoft?
It was a Ubisoft game. It wasn't developed by them. It was published by them. Isn't it Free Radical?
Yeah, isn't it the game that killed Free Radical?
Yeah.
that's bad.
55, Jesse.
Not even below 50.
No. Jesse scores the point.
I want to know what Gangs of London scored, because I remember that being very bad. And I always wanted to play it because it looked
cool.
I thought
Gangs of London was a Sky Atlantic series.
Isn't it based on the game?
It is based on the PSP game that was a spin-off from The Getaway.
From The Getaway, yeah.
No results found, weirdly.
No one reviewed Gangs of London.
It definitely does exist. Let me just have a look. I'm now curious. Gangs of London game. Gangs of London video game. Metacritic, it does have a Metacritic, it's just that Metacritic's annoying. 52. Could have had even lower.
Got a 4.5 from IGN.
Did it?
What, Gangs of London?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What do we say? No, doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Next category. I want the lowest Metacritic for a game released by Capcom.
Oh, okay. See,
I feel like Resident Evil comes to mind, but then it's like, I don't know.
What was your question, Joe?
It wasn't a question. I was just going to remark that I find it's annoying in the context of this game, but I find it nice that I've realized about myself that I remember good things, not shit things. I feel like I'm a more positive person than I thought I was. I have got one, but Jesse goes first.
Yeah, Jesse, what are you giving me? You're trying
Lost
to choose
Planet 3.
Lost Planet 3.
That's a good one.
Because that game was shit, and I enjoyed the first two games.
Yeah.
Lost Planet 3 is 61.
Okay.
On
I'm hoping I can beat that with Oh god, is this the bad one? I think it is. Resident Evil Operation Raccoon City.
Oh yeah, you've won. Fuck. I'm an idiot. I should have chosen that. That's such an obvious choice.
52. Joe gets the point.
I was trying to think, like, what shit games to do. Like, Dino Crisis 3 was one of them.
Oh, but people kind of liked that one, though, right? That was the space one.
Yeah, but there has to be a shit Mega Man game that people absolutely
that's
despise.
That's the thing. It's going to be one of those, like, Game Boy port Mega Man.
Mega Man Triple X 52 HD edition or some shit.
Dino Crisis.
Triple X.
Dino Crisis 3 would have got you a 51.
Oh.
Right. Next
Rock
category.
Man indeed. Sorry, Carol.
Games with animal mascots.
What does that mean?
The classic kind of
name
platformer.
A good one.
I don't know, like the most
like
recent
Banjo-Kazooie.
Yeah, something like that.
So do they have to be a main character?
Yeah, they are the. Yeah. I've probably phrased it wrong, but you know the animal mascot games. So you've got your Sonics, your Crash Bandicoots, your Banjo-Kazooies, that kind of game.
I just want to confirm, but it can't be a game that.
Where you play as an animal that does shit.
Okay, so. Like, can it be a game that just has animals in it, but is based in reality?
But as in, like, you play as a man with a gun, but there just happens to be a squirrel on a fence.
No,
you can't
so
have that, Jesse.
You're thinking of Tokyo Jungle, aren't you?
I'm thinking of, like, I don't know, Barbie Horse Adventure. Something
no,
like that.
No,
because then you're playing as Barbie.
An animal platformer kind of style game. Yeah. The classic 90s platformers, stuff like that.
Okay.
I'm going to go... I'm first, aren't I?
You are, Joe.
I'm just guessing this exists. Mm-hmm. Croc 2.
Croc 2 does exist. I played that as a child.
Is that Legend of the Gobbos?
It is Legend of the
Gobbos.
Is that
a PlayStation game?
I had it on PC, but I think it was on PlayStation 1. The problem is, Joe, you're predating Metacritic at this point.
Oh, okay. All right. That's fine. Oh, it wasn't Legend of the Gobbos.
Is it not? Is it Croc 1 Legend of the
Gobbos? The first one is Legend of the Gobbos.
Is Croc a platformer?
Yeah, you play as a crocodile.
It's shithouse.
I mean, it's still your go, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Shite. That's the problem. I bet loads of the animal mascots go... What about... fuck it. Blinks the Time Sweeper. That's probably one people liked at the time when because it was a launch game or something.
71.
Yeah.
All right.
You got 71 to beat, Jesse.
Sonic Boom. Whatever that Sonic game was.
Sonic Boom.
People hated that one.
Good one.
Led to a TV show, didn't it, Sonic Boom?
I actually think of Sonic as a real man, so...
I was going to say Shadow the Hedgehog, but I figured that people enjoy that game.
Jesse, I'm going to give you a choice now.
Oh, okay.
Because Sonic Boom created two games, so do you want...
Shattered
actually,
Crystal.
Three. Yes. So are you going for Shattered Crystal? Okay. Shatter Crystal, 47 Metacritic.
Oh, he's got the bonus.
If
everything.
You'd gone for the Wii U one, you would have got...
The Wii U port is better.
No, the Wii U one was called The Rise of Lyric. That would have got you a 32.
Damn.
But
well.
Jesse gets it with the bonus point.
See, the problem is I can't name any good Sonic games because I don't know
sure
any.
You can, Sonic 2.
What was the Sonic
I never played
before
it, though.
Sonic Boom?
Sonic Heroes. No, that was the GameCube one.
No. There was one that tried to be...
Is it the Werewolf one?
No, there was one that tried to be Mario Galaxy.
No. It's probably just called Sonic Galaxy Zoom Zoom or some shit.
Galaxy. Lost World. That was it.
Oh, okay. Right. It's not Sonic Galaxy Zoom
Zoom. There was one good level in that game where you had to push big... fruits into blenders and it would make like juice fountains that you could fly out of. That was quite cool. But the
that
rest
sounds
was shit.
Delicious.
It was.
Right. Penultimate round. Movie tie-ins.
Mm.
That's good. But again, a difficult one with regard to...
Wait. Okay, no, I get it.
Based on a, like, and...
Okay.
No.
I know the game.
Okay. Jesse's got a game. Have you got one, Joe?
No, but he can go.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory on the PS2.
Ooh.
That's
I got that game as a present, and it was not to knock a present, because, you know, you get it for free. It was a fucking dreadful game, and it upset me greatly.
Specifically the PS2 version, Jesse?
Yeah, because that's the one I got. Okay. I don't know if it got any other ports. It was probably on, like, the GameCube.
Okay. You've got to beat this one, Joe. 35!
Nice. I'm going to go for that Lost Pirates of the Caribbean game on PS2. I can't remember the subtitle.
I had that.
A Lost Pirates of the Caribbean?
No, it's like a forgotten one. People were talking about it the other day and saying it was bollocks.
It was based on... It was like... It used the entirety of the same mechanics of another pirate game, and I'm trying to remember what it was, and it's just reskinned. Literally, you know when people complain about like reskins? It's just like, you're talking bollocks. Like, there's a lot of work being put into this. This was near enough a reskin of another game. Just
that was Legend of Jack Sparrow.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah. Oh my God, look at the state of his face.
I want to see it now.
Legend of Jack Sparrow. You've got a choice here, Joe. Do you want it on PC or PS2?
PS2.
PS2. 51.
The PC port would absolutely be worse, because it would have been a separate game. That's what I imagine. Because Spider-Man 2, PlayStation 2 version, was completely different compared to the PC version. I feel like it's in that era.
Published by Bethesda and Ubisoft.
It was, yeah. I think the PC version of that was actually might have been very similar to the but the PC version did get worse. It was 49 on Metacritic.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory game is a big shout. I love it.
That absolute game genius. Scarred me, man, and I hated that fucking film as well.
Okay. Right. Final round, bit of a twist. I want an EA game but based not on the critic score, but based on the user score.
Oh, that's a good one.
Which game upset EA players the most?
I mean, I think the user score for the one I've got in mind has probably altered significantly since.
The game I'm thinking of.
It depends on if people care enough to go and put a changed score.
EA games, yeah?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of the first ever pay-to-win controversy that I heard about.
This is tough. This is the thing. All the user reviews all the time, they're going to be stupidly positive for most of this
shit. Or stupidly negative because something happened.
I'm just going to have to go for Star Wars Battlefront 2. The remake, not the original. But I think that one may have garnered enough support since that it's pushed it right back.
But enough people decided they wanted to go on Metacritic and boost it back up. Let's have a look.
But it's one of the biggest mega ones that we've seen.
I don't even think this will be on Metacritic, what I'm going to suggest.
Joe. It's really a 1.5.
Oh, shit.
Battlefront 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, because everyone hated it when it came out.
But no one went back to update it. No. That is ridiculous.
Got to beat 1.5, Jesse.
It's going to be impossible. I was going to go for Medal of Honor Rising Sun, but I remembered a video I watched. I'm going to go for Dungeon Keeper, because I know people hated that.
That can't be on Metacritic user scores, can it?
As in, which version of Dungeon Keeper?
Because they had the mobile version.
So you're talking about the mobile version. Oh. The mobile version of Dungeon Keeper, right?
That was the one where I remember where microtransactions really fucked the game up. And that's Jesse. Did I win?
Jesse, my boy. 0.3.
Nice.
User score.
Monster.
So Jesse
How
gets
do you remember the fucking
point.
Mobile version of Dungeon
Keeper? No, because when it comes to like controversy surrounding like loot boxes, Dungeon Keeper is the one where people get upset about. It's still a dead series. Didn't they try to bring it back and they made the same mistake or something?
I'm not sure.
I can't remember.
I love Dungeon Keeper 2.
Right, scores are in. Joe, 2 points.
Yeah. Fuck.
Jesse, 7.
Massive.
I do consume a lot of just shite media, to be fair. It's quite telling, really, these games.
Big Jesse energy in this game. He loves it.
Good game, boys.
Oh, very good. All right, let's do some feedback, which starts with the winner of all things shite.
This is from Elliot. He says, hey team, hope you're all well and getting jabbed with plenty of vaccines up there in the Northern Hemisphere. Probably not plenty, maximum two, I think. Yeah. I've written in before, often after a few drinks, with weird stuff, which I can only apologize for. So this one is a bit more on the normal end of the spectrum. So I bought a Switch recently and started mainlining Mario Odyssey. Got myself to the Metro Zone in about 100 to 150 moons when suddenly my Switch broke and had to take it back for a replacement. I'm now faced with the prospect of starting again and playing the same bit of game all over again, not an insurmountable challenge, but I have little patience and just can't see myself doing it. And I feel like I'm going to shut myself off for the rest of the game and will just start Breath of the Wild instead. Keen to know if any of you lot have had this kind of experience with games. Maybe you had a ton of progress, didn't save and lost it, so you never went back. Did you start a TV show? It got taken off Netflix before you finished it and just too long passed before you picked up again. Keep up the great work and don't even think about not respecting the sea. Cheers, Elliot from Melbourne.
I can't think of like a Switch breakage a console breakage.
You're getting really emotional.
Yeah, no, I was crying, not burping. but I think this is quite a common complaint amongst people in our industry, which is the very long preview event, mm-hmm. where you go and you play like 5 hours of a game, and then 3 months later you're like, oh my god, I have to do that again. Like, I've done that. I did that for both of the last two Tomb Raider games. Like,
that's mad.
Huge intro preview events, which are, I should say, amazing when you want to do the preview. Like, that's such a privilege. And like a great way to preview something because you're actually getting a look at what the thing is. But when you get back to it and you're like, I'm going to play that game I liked, you're like, oh my god, I have to teach Lara how to apply mud again.
Yeah, I think I did. Like, I did a lot around Shadow of the Tomb. Back at my old job, I was the Tomb Raider guy. I got all of the Tomb Raider stuff. So I'd seen like the start of Shadow of the Tomb Raider like 4 times by the time I actually got around to it. On a positive side, I played the opening of Final Fantasy VII Remake a lot and still loved it and still love it to this day. On a less positive side, I played so much Immortals over preview and got very excited for that game and loved everything that it was doing. But when everything they showed me is from the start of the game, and so when it came out and I sat down and was like, I love everything what this game is, I've just played this opening like 5 times now. It's just... I haven't played it 5 times,
it strikes me as a Christmas game, Immortals. Like, you sit down, you're like, one day at Christmas, you'll be like, I'm just going to do this.
The thing is, though, is like, by the time we get to next Christmas, there's going to be something else that is of that kind of grade. And I do worry that, like, my time with Immortals has been lost now and I should have grabbed it at the time. Admittedly, I think Assassin's Creed Valhalla is better, and so that's why it got my time that year. But it's one of those... I almost know lines of Immortals by heart now because and obviously that was again one of these things of it was an IGN first, so we got real in-depth access to that game, which meant that we got to play that intro a lot. We got to see all of the cutscenes as many times as we wanted and all of that. Great for coverage, less so for your enthusiasm.
I can't think of any games where I played where, you know, my hardware's broke or the game disc is just completely clapped. But this is just going to be, I mean, it's my answer, isn't it? Like, God of War, I played during release and I got, you know, a good amount of hours into, and I just kind of stopped playing. It might have been because of uni or school or whatever. And then maybe a year ago, I tried playing it again and I basically got halfway through and I was just like, I'm just not really fussed. And it's one of those games where it's like, this is like the best game ever for that generation. And I play it and I'm just like, it's not doing anything for me. And then you have the people who are like, you need to play this game. I'm just like, I'm not bothered because there's so many games coming out all the time. Like, I don't want to just sit there and play. I don't know. It's weird.
That sounds like a slightly different situation though, right? That's you just not being fussed about God of War rather than not wanting to mainline through all of the stuff that you previously played of it.
Yeah, but like playing through it like twice, I guess that was the similar hook, I guess. But I've never really had a game like that, I guess.
I think there's something to be said for like DLC or like expansions when you, particularly for RPGs, like something comes out 4 months after you finish the game, and then you get to it and you're like, oh my god, I have to remember how to play this game, and then the DLC is going to be really long and hard. Really, honestly, the only DLC I can remember playing after having finished the game at launch and then just going straight back into it is like The Witcher, and that's just because The Witcher's amazing, and I was happy to remind myself how the fuck that weird game works.
I played the intermission, which is obviously the Final Fantasy VII mission, and that obviously I haven't played Final Fantasy VII for a year. Like, it was last March, wasn't it, that came out, and it's not necessarily that it's super super difficult, but you play as one character, and for the first section of that DLC you don't have anybody with you at all, and suddenly it's reminding yourself, how do you use this combat system with just one character? It's a combat system that's designed for parties to bounce off each other, and you do eventually get another party member who is all completely AI controlled. But I remember the first two dogs that you fight in that DLC took me about six attempts to do, because I'd completely forgotten how to play Final Fantasy.
Yeah, I think, I hope it never happens to me that something breaks and I lose loads of progress, because 100 moons in Mario Odyssey is no joke. Sods, Elliot. Yeah. Matt, you're up next.
Oh, yes, this one is from Simon, who says, "Hi, gents. A few episodes ago, you spoke about coincidences where game characters named after family members resulted in a bit of a mindfuck moment. It's not quite the same, but it reminded me of a time when I was a few hours into Peter Molyneux Lionhead's God Sim Black and White. Playing it around 2 a.m, I was half asleep when suddenly through the headphones I heard a soft, cold, beckoning whisper of... Simon."
I was delighted with your delivery on that.
"Now wide awake, I sat bolt upright in my chair, looked around the room quickly before staring at the screen for a few moments. After being freaked out for a good 5 minutes, I dug around in the game's files and eventually found an MP3 of someone whispering hundreds of names, which was quite funny to listen to, but before I found that, I was, as you can imagine, a bit on edge. A good piece of immersion from Lionhead Studios. What is Peter Molyneux up to these days? Cheers, from Simon."
To your question, I don't know what the fuck Peter Molyneux's up to these days. I would love to know. 22 Cans still exists, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Is Peter Molyneux the guy who did the Kinect game with the weird, scary kid?
Yeah.
And the person taught, yeah. That's all I really remember of him.
They are apparently working on he's working on something called Legacy, apparently. But their last thing was in 2016, where they did the Trail Frontier Challenge.
Oh, people said that was all right.
It must have been better than... Because obviously Goddess was the horrendous mistake.
Yeah. And then they made Goddess Wars, which I've never even heard of.
I have a feeling, you know, that might have just been like the combat sequences ripped out of Goddess. Yeah. Like one of those, like, realizing that they'd reached too far, so if you curb it back, you can make a game out of what you've got.
What, Peter Molyneux doing that? I genuinely love Peter Molyneux for being mad.
I do as well. I genuinely have a soft spot for him.
Yeah, I know, like... The thing that teaches me about what it's like to be a proper Peter Molyneux fan is watching my brother, when he was quite young, following the development of Fable 2 for, like, 3 years, and it being the only thing in the world he wanted to play. Like, everything he read about it, he would come and talk to me about and be like... Oh my god, have you heard what they're going to do in Fable 2? Then when it came out, people who hadn't been following that game really like Fable 2. Like, people love it. My brother thought it was the worst game ever made. He was like, where is this, and had this, like, 50-point list of stuff that he was furious wasn't in the game. Yeah. And that is sad, but as someone who isn't, like, following each of those games really closely, I think there's something really nice about someone who's just like, I just want to do loads of shit. Like, that's exciting.
That's one of the things that I admire about the fact that, like, and I know this came, he's from an era before PR slammed the lockdown on everything, but I love that he was just a dude that he's got all of these ideas and he wants you to experience all of these ideas. It just turns out that, like, games never work that way, and there's always a publisher or there's always somebody on the money strings that just like, you can't do that, this isn't possible, or you came up with an idea and you try to make it work and it just turns out the tech just won't allow that through. But I do remember the big conversation of, I can't remember if it was 2 or Fable 1, which was, if you plant an acorn over your character's lifetime, the tree will sprout, you'll then be able to cut the tree down and, like, use that to craft an axe or whatever. And it's a shame that none of that came to be. I still think, like, the Fable games are really good RPGs, especially for their time.
Is he not working on Fable 4? Or is that... Oh.
Oh no, Peter. That man will never work on a AAA game again.
I think that's the thing. I think the reason, part of the reason I have like a fondness for Peter Molyneux, particularly now, is that that era is over.
Yeah.
And so there's no way that I can have the rug pulled out from me. So now I just look back with rose-tinted spectacles at like, look how weird that was. Yeah. That we had this guy who could just say whatever he wanted.
The likes of him still exist. Like, what's the guy that runs Star Citizen? Chris...
Chris Roberts.
Yeah. He's just the current... I don't know, he's obviously from the same era as Peter Molyneux. He's just still...
The difference is he has the money.
Well, I mean, that's exactly it, is that, like, if your money only comes from Patreons and like, Kickstarters rather than an actual publisher that has got a accountant and a project manager, then it's sort of become slightly different.
I love that you're implying Star Citizen doesn't have an accountant on it. It's the highest grossing crowdfunded project of all time. And to be fair, if you want to see what it would be like if Peter Molyneux existed now, look at how angry people are at Chris Roberts all the time. I guess that's what we're I guess that's what we're talking about. Jesse's pointing at himself.
I am one of them.
I have a rather different email from the returning Brock Sewell, who came in last week to tell us about his adventures across Europe driving a manual car when he didn't know how to. We asked during that, he said at the end that learning Japanese had taught him how to swear at a creepy man in an onsen, and we invited Brock to write back in, and he did. So he said, "Cheers, lads, for reading out my email last week, just in time for my birthday." Happy birthday, Brock.
Happy birthday.
To Jesse and Simon's comments, the reason I travel so much is that I'm an ESL teacher. Instagram and Facebook's advert algorithms are so fucked, they alternate between apply for a US green card, request to donate my sperm for the 2049 Tour de France, don't know what that means, and post-Brexit requests from the UK government, which seem to think I'm a German exchange student. Time will tell if any are true. Now, on to the onsen story. There I was with some friends, soaking in a big bath the morning after an all-you-can-drink affair called a Nomi Hodai. I've done a Nomi Hodai, and what he is about to describe is correct. You basically pay 20 quid and spend the next 2 hours trying not to die. It had likely cut a year from our lives, and as we were struggling to put our shattered pieces back in order, up saunters this crotchety old bastard. Imagine a walking piece of beef jerky with its balls out, and you've got him sorted. He was utterly amazed by our group. A Geordie, a weedy Irishman, an Eritrean who could have been a male model, and me, a giant American. All as naked as he, and all looking as if we had been just punched in the soul. He squats down, putting us eye level with his dusty bits, and starts rattling away in Japanese, which I could barely understand past the three teeth wandering around in his mouth. Very beautiful descriptions. As his son shouts from the changing room to hurry up, the old geezer suddenly stands up and straddles an invisible motorbike. Pointing at the Geordie, he hops up and down, shouting, you look like you know how to ride. Next, he points at the Eritrean and wonders aloud if he's really a woman who had accidentally walked into the wrong bath. Finally, he looks at the Irishman and wags a finger. Now you look like you know how to fuck. This is wild. Then, with an image that will be forever scarred on the back of my retinas, he grabs two fistfuls of air and starts thrusting with more vigour and excitement than any 89-year-old should ever possess. And I cannot stress this enough, each of these proclamations, each enthusiastic accompanying gesture is being done completely starkers. His son's increasing shouts to hurry up are now met with furious argument midway through robust renditions of our friend's sexual prowess. We decide then it was time to go before one of us loses an eye. Bold as brass, he does something that is definitely illegal. Alarmed, I took hold of the shallow puddle that is my Japanese proficiency and shout, "Stop, you bastard!" and in a sudden flourish add, "Suika, suika," or suika, the Japanese word for pervert, or so I thought. The old man froze and tilted his head. Looking between his own legs, then back at me, he flashes a big grin. As we flee the scene, he resumed his hip churning behind us, even as his son starts pelting him with bath towels. His weird reaction to my words stayed with me for hours. I could not, for the life of me, understand until I finally pulled up a dictionary. Turns out I hadn't shouted pervert, as I previously believed. I had shouted watermelon! Watermelon! The cheeky fucker thought I'd been complimenting the size of his balls. In any case, I use the incident as catalyst to resume studying the language in earnest to avoid bolstering any more old creeps into thrust-groping fellow bar patrons. And that, lads, is the tamest of my many horrifying onsen stories.
Just go to a good onsen, man.
And then he says some nice things. Cheers again, Brock, still in South Korea. Brock, I'm sorry you went through that. But
yeah.
I'm glad that you told us about the watermelon story.
That old man genuinely sounds like a character from, like, Killer 7 or something that Suda 51 would create or something.
It does sound like a Suda 51 character. You're absolutely right. Right. That's that for the bit of the podcast where it won't destroy your enjoyment of an ongoing pop culture product. Because after a very short break, in which maybe we'll play some of the music from Loki, which is very good, we will talk all about Loki up to the end of episode 4. So if you haven't seen it, piss off.
Go away.
Gents, are you both up to date on Loki?
Uh-huh, I am indeed.
Yeah, of course, mate.
Yeah, we're all pop cultural mavens. how are you finding it? I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably not grabbed me quite as much as some of the other shows, but I think
I agree.
I conceptually like it more than any of them. It's just there's, I don't really know what it is about it. I love the world building. I love the visual design of it. I love the artistry in it. There's something that hasn't quite pulled me in as much, but I do think this most recent episode is the one that has pulled my investment in substantially more. I think there's some real cool stuff going on now.
I have to say I am liking it quite a lot more than the other shows. WandaVision, that's maybe more a retrospect thing, because I think I was really enjoying that for a long time. I just thought it didn't stick the landing. Falcon and Winter Soldier, I just didn't think was that good. It's not that I didn't enjoy it, I just didn't. It didn't do much for me past episode one, until the end. Whereas this is the one where I feel like going into every episode now, I know I'm going to see something wild. I know, I really admire Loki's commitment to just talking.
Yeah.
There's way less fighting than most Marvel things. And I'm really, and there's obviously still fighting because they can't help themselves. But
yeah,
I do like that there are whole scenes of just two people sitting across a table having a chat or discussing something that means something to them. And I really, and I think that that's putting Tom Hiddleston to good use. Sofia DiMartino, who I don't know if I've seen in anything this substantial before, I think she's great. Owen Wilson's playing a brilliant character for Owen Wilson. He's somehow being Owen Wilson at the same time as
it just
not
seems
indulging
like it's
the Wilson-y
him.
Stuff. Yeah. Yeah. But but it feels like him, but actually as the middle-aged man he is, not
Wedding Crashers kind
not,
of
well,
Owen.
Not Owen Wilson playing Owen Wilson from 20 years ago, which often people get him to do. And
yeah.
I really like that. He's very appealing. I think there's a lot about it I admire. I'm enjoying it. Jesse, how are you with it?
I think since Endgame, which I felt was the perfect ending for me, I've not been begging for more Marvel media. I'm not as invested into Marvel as I am, Star Wars, for example. But with Loki, I agree, it's probably been the most I've been interested in one of these Marvel TV shows, just because of the setting. It kind of reminds me of, I don't know, a Control SCP kind of deal, just with how it looks. And I quite enjoy that. But with Loki, it's not like I'm, I can't wait until next Wednesday for another episode, or I'm going nuts. It's not one of those shows where I'm going to the subreddits and checking out other people's theories and watching explainer videos and whatnot. I'm enjoying it, but I'm not holy shit, I can't wait for another episode. But episode 4 did, it changed it a little bit, because I want to see what's happening next, just because of, the twist, essentially.
I think we all liked episode 4 a little more than our reviewer on IGN did, but I think that review did, I think the point that review made, which I totally agreed with, was the best thing that episode did was leave you really excited for the next one because of the potential of what things meant. It resolved a lot of mysteries slightly earlier than you might have expected, which always has that effect of where the fuck is this gonna go?
Yeah.
Which I think is really exciting.
I sort of like that it kind of felt a bit like a season finale, but at the middle point of it.
Yes,
obviously we are spoiler like the safety's off on spoilers, right? So we can talk about it. So you get kind of like, you know, Mobius is pruned, is the word that they use, which is obviously pulled out of the timeline. So you instantly, like halfway through this episode, get a point where you think, oh shit, one of the lead characters in this has been killed quite unceremoniously as well, which just made it feel like the one thing that I like at its world building is it's incredibly bureaucratic. They sort of remind me a bit of the Vogons from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Just kind of like there's so much fucking paperwork in that world. It's so just the worst of kind of just like keeping track of stuff. So you get that happen. You then get obviously the whole stuff of then Loki being sort of like pruned as well. But before that, you get the whole timekeepers thing. Me and you were talking about this, Joe. I love that kind of, they're almost like the prophets from Halo, just kind of like in this big kind of throne room arrangement. I love the smoke, the red lights, the, again, because it sort of riffs on Doctor Who, it's got a bit of that, like, the legacy of Gallifrey going on there. But then it just turns out that they're sort of, like, things out of Five Nights at Freddy's, basically.
Well, it's just Wizard of Oz, isn't
it? Yeah, like, that's what I was going to say. Were you lot expecting this twist? Because I remember going online and people were like, oh, my God, I couldn't believe that happened.
No, me and Joe had spoken about this weeks ago.
It was so bait because previous episodes were like, oh, only I'm allowed to see the timekeepers and no one else can get an appointment. I'm like, they're blatantly not real to some degree.
What I kind of liked about that is that when they did turn up, there was a bit of me that was like, okay, so maybe they are sticking with the idea that they're real.
Yeah.
You know, they are special aliens. And then you got a close look at them, and I was like, they look really shit. they look like bad effects. And then it's because they are bad effects. Like, that's genuinely a good little switcheroo where I was like, they're kind of, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe I'm being too kind to them. But to me, I read it as they purposely made them look quite bad so that you would go, when the reveal comes in, you're like, oh yeah, it's because
could you understand what they were saying? Because I had to record the episode obviously without subtitles because I was doing our review, and I was like, I can't understand shit from what they're saying.
I watch it always with subs, and one of these things, especially with Loki, because there's quite a lot of like in-universe jargon in this one compared to the other ones. Because I'll inevitably do work out of the other side of it, I tend to watch with subtitles just to make sure. I did this, like, The Witcher was impossible to watch without subs because there's so much mad stuff being spoken about. Yeah. But yeah, we got that. And then obviously, I sort of wish that the post-credits had been kept for the starting scene of next week's episode, just so you got the mystery of what pruning actually does to people. But that whole thing of, like, it doesn't kill you, it displaces you somewhere else. Loki waking up in what looks like a New York apocalypse to be faced by more very exciting variants.
Including Richard E. fucking Grant.
What a choice.
So good.
Oh, his costume is excellent. They've got him in the nappy.
He's so gross looking. I love it. They've made a really old, nice man wear a horrible spandex costume.
Is that kid with the alligator Loki? Are they together or is alligator Loki separate?
Alligator Loki is a Loki.
Oh, he's so cute. I want a little alligator Loki.
I was going to say something. Well, so to your point on the mid-credits thing, this to me was the first time they justified, really, apart from final episode Marvel type stuff, to me this was the first time that the mid-credits really felt justified, because I saw a bunch of people who hadn't waited for the mid-credits go onto Twitter to be like, oh my god, they've cryptically, but kind of saying too much still, chill out everyone on Twitter, going like, holy shit, I can't believe they actually did that.
Yeah.
And then 10 minutes later, someone's clearly gone, oh, you haven't watched the mid-credits. And I think that is actually quite a nice use of that. Like, we're not going to include one for ages, and then we'll drop one without you knowing. Mm-hmm. Whereas when WandaVision did it, I was kind of like, why? Why are we doing this now?
Yeah.
Out of nowhere? Like, why didn't we just save this right for the very end? Like, the one where fucking, the WandaVision one where there's, like, the basement.
Yeah.
Was just like, what's the fucking point in this? Like, this is just for the sake of it. Whereas, yeah, I thought this one kind of worked for me. But I see your point about keeping it to the next week. And
it's just like, it was its moment to have a bit of a, you know, we haven't had a good Game of Thrones style wedding cliffhanger in a show for a while. And, like, I think there was a part of that lack of ceremony sort of already clues you into the fact that there's probably something more to it.
Yep.
But and obviously no one ever truly dies in a Marvel show.
Yeah.
But it is now a case of seeing Loki reunited with like these four other Loki variants. It's like, well, does that mean we're going to get to see Mobius's variants?
Yeah, the Owen Wilson verse. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm into that.
Because if one of them is on a jet ski, if he gets to see his other life where he finishes on a jet ski,
well, it feels like, I guess, you know, we got shown quite clearly that they have these time cells and all that kind of stuff. Like, you do wonder whether this is like everyone who gets pruned just gets stuck in a world of their own together, and like, that's quite a cool, horrible, like dystopian thing. I think that's a fun idea.
Yeah,
do you think we have like? Do you think three more episodes is enough to get to know who the actual villain is? Because obviously the timekeepers were meant to was being set up as, you know, the main guys, and now they're just, you know, little Timmy and a robot.
I think, you know, there is, because one of the things that I didn't expect from this, but the more I think about it, it's probably in its benefit. It's actually quite a small scale show. I was expecting it to be a lot more like Doctor Who and Star Trek, where it was constantly bouncing from planet to reality to different dimension through all of these different time periods. And it's just not that show at all. It's actually really remarkably small scale. So I think that because it hasn't set up anything much more really beyond that, like the main mystery of it is who are the timekeepers, and what exactly is kind of like the problem. I don't think there's much more it needs to massively solve. We need to find out kind of like what Sylvie's kind of like history is, why they do what they do, and kind of exactly, I think, what is the sacred timeline is kind of the big question of the series, because it's clearly not like a God-given sort of deal, right? It's not.
Yeah.
There's something more sinister about it. I think, like, it's got 2 hours to do that in. That's an entire movie.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
One thing, like, the one thing about the small scale thing, which I agree is nice, like, because it doesn't feel too weighty. It doesn't feel like you're having to run up against loads of stuff. They went with the him seeing that Infinity Stones meant nothing here thing, and this is this the greatest power in the universe, which they keep coming back to in every previously on. So it feels like they really want to get that across. It does slightly jar that you're in this, like, this is a small-scale mystery that just happens to invalidate 23 movies.
Like, I sort of like that about it, though. It's kind of like...
It just feels like, it just feels odd. I wonder how they're going to get out of it. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's writing yourself into a very odd corner that you have to deal with after that point. Like, is Loki after this fact? If indeed this version of Loki ever interacts with anyone else in the MCU as we know it again, which presumably he will because people like him too much.
Yeah.
If he does, do we just end up in a point where, like, he just has to turn up and be like, tell everyone how useless and shit they all are. Like, and we have to, and will that mean anything on camera?
But,
like,
but I guess not. In their specific timeline, it means everything, right? Like, that's the only tools they have in terms of the Infinity Stones actually do anything.
Yeah, but
I
then
guess.
You as a viewer is still like,
yeah, wow. Like, it doesn't really matter. I mean,
it's
that's like,
odd.
Yeah, I feel like it's the same feeling I have with, you know, the Black Widow film. It's like, I know she's dead. And I know it's probably a fun film, but I'm not feeling invested enough to watch it because, like, it's the same with the Han Solo story. Like, I don't need to know their backstory. I like the character that they were. I don't need everything explained to me, which I feel like Black Widow might do.
I felt that way with the Solo film, but I really like the Solo film because in knowing what happens to that character, it just becomes like an adventure movie. And
yeah,
I was
okay.
fine with that. I just enjoyed like the ride of that movie, and I'm kind of hoping Black Widow's the same. Like, I know a lot of people have kind of come out of it, and I haven't seen it, so I don't know how much I agree with this. But I know lots of people have come out of it going like, "Oh, it really dials you into the emotion of Black Widow's death," and you know, like, it has a kind of repercussive effect. But honestly, that's not what I'm in it for. I just want to see her like kicking people and doing like scissor attacks and shit. Like, I'm fine with that. I'm interested, like, but I do see that, like, there is a certain amount of like invalidating yourself just by where you put it in the timeline.
I think that's the thing with like Marvel and Star Wars or stuff, like whether it's prequel or sequel content or whatever, like there's always these films are never standalone. There's always a wider discussion that happens for so damn long, and it's hard to avoid that, so it kind of gets stuck in your head. Like it'll be hard for me to watch Black Widow as just a fun action film, which I'm sure it is, because then you go on Twitter and you go elsewhere and it's always a discussion of like, oh, this is what this means, this is what invalidates, or this is what it does validate and stuff. You just can't really escape it.
It's always hurt Marvel to a certain, or Marvel cinematic stuff to a certain extent. Like, right down to, you know, the Marvel Netflix stuff, I actually really liked the idea of those being, you know, the street level heroes and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But even then, they couldn't help themselves than have references to the Avengers and stuff. And when you do that, you suddenly put all of this into context, you know, like, well, if you're telling me that this is so meaningless in the grand scheme of things, like, it's hard. It's like an extra lift to get you there. And I thought, like, season one of Daredevil did that quite well, but maybe season one of Jessica Jones, which I didn't like as much as some, but I definitely see the merits there. But, like, when you're looking at, like, Iron Fist is a man with actual superpowers, and even then I'm like, you're fucking useless, mate. Like, I should think he's amazing.
Picturing what issues they have in the TV shows and thinking how they would perform in Endgame feels like they'll get killed instantly. Yeah,
isn't this the point of Marvel, that like there's a superhero for every, like, it's supposed to be reflective of like actual universe, right?
But I think that's maybe the Marvel Cinematic Universe's problem, is that it has to be so much more focused, whereas the comics can cheaply sprawl. You're left with cinematic universe constantly being shown, like, here's the next big bad, here's the next threat, here's the thing that you need to measure up, like, who's the most powerful. They're doing all those discussions all those times, so it's relatively impossible to like detach yourself from that conversation. But I do see your point. Like, maybe that's a failure of imagination on my part as opposed to Marvel's.
I've always quite liked, like, with the, because I think I am a little bit more favourable to the Netflix stuff. It does get real bad, but certainly its first few years, I think it was quite successful. But I quite liked that there was just this idea of kind of like the occasional reminder. It's sort of like you are at a point where, like, as you say, these people are on the streets and there's only so far that they can save the people of their neighbourhood, which is why Matt Murdock is so focused on Hell's Kitchen. It's like, this man just isn't capable of doing the stuff that everybody else does, and that's why you get a very different storyline with him. But going back, spinning this back round to the Infinity Stones, I think that there's a good chance that the end of Loki will actually introduce whatever the next big bad for the MCU is, because it's a show that starts with pointing out that actually there's a part of this universe in which Infinity Stones are kind of pretty much useless. They're paperweights. So it almost sets you up as like, at some point this show has to explain what is grander than that. A lot of people have spoken about Kang the Conqueror being the potential there. I think that's got a good chance.
Can you explain Kang the Conqueror to me, please?
I don't even know who he is.
So it's been a long time since I read a storyline with Kang the Conqueror in, so I do apologise to anybody at home that starts screaming saying that I've got it wrong. But he is like, the comic that I read him in, he is kind of like a time manipulator, and Avengers Forever is the story I've read him in, where he plucks Avengers from across time. So that's really interesting, because the Avengers team that's in that comic is like, you've got Captain America at the point where he's having a crisis because he's realized he's a man out of time and realized that he can't deal with the modern world. You've got Ant-Man at the point where he's a horrendous wife beater, but you've also got Ant-Man.
I didn't know that, the character.
You've also got Ant-Man before he knows that he's going to become a horrendous wife beater. And so you've got the two of them interacting from two very different parts of their life. But obviously Kang is this massive time manipulator. So I think the whole idea of like this being about the TVA, I think there's a real good chance that the person that's been manipulating all of this sacred timeline nonsense through these puppets could well be Kang the Conqueror.
Right.
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah,
it sounds like having the worst versions of the Avengers trying to do something together sounds actually kind of cool.
Yeah. It's such a good comic. Like, it's a long one.
It's an
as well.
Old comic.
Yeah, like, I say old, like late 1980s, maybe early 1990s. It's great. It's a genuinely great story if anybody wants to go and read that.
Oh, he looks cool as well. I like it.
I mean, he's blue and purple, isn't he? He's kind of got a bit of Thanos to him.
He looks menacing.
And so in the comics, is he seen as like bigger than Thanos, etc., etc.?
It depends on what era of comics you read, because the moment the MCU turned up, then Thanos was just big again. Like, he hadn't been around for years, and then it was just a case of, we're going to stick Thanos in everything. Our next big event is Thanos. It's such a... That universe has been massively manipulated by what's popular in either cartoons or, like, the Spider-Man movies of the time. But, yeah, he's considered one of the... He's not Galactus, so... Yeah. And, you know, he's not the Celestials or anything like that, but, like, he is in that pantheon of kind of pretty strong cross-universe sort of bad guys.
But the next big bad would have to be bigger than Thanos, though, wouldn't it? Because it would have to be a threat that's, like, comparable or stronger, I guess, in some sense.
Yeah, I think there's an element of one-upping. I sort of wish they'd go smaller. I think it'd be really nice to have, like, a couple of phases which were, like, dealing with more kind of, like, smaller threats.
Like, MODOK.
But I think they will. Like, that's what, you know, you look at what they did with the first few Marvel phases, and, like, that's what they did. Like, Ultron was the big bad, and when you look at him in the context of those movies, you're like, he was shit house. Like, he's just a big tin man with the voice of a horrible man. Like, he's... Oh, no, he's not the horrible man. I'm thinking of James Woods, not James Spader. I apologize to James Spader. You're just weird.
I mean, James Spader's the bad guy in Blacklist, isn't it? Or
I don't think... I was impugning I was impugning the personality of the actor.
The office, yeah.
And unfortunately, I meant James Woods. He is a dickhead. I think there's, like... I think you can look back, and I do think the next two phases probably will be...
Mm-hmm.
For want of a better term, smaller scale villains, which I'm
Iron Man 2 level villain.
Because I think they will do, like, teen Avengers at some point, or young Avengers at some point, and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Like I've said before, I'm just ready for them to, like, throw lots of new people at me. And maybe that's, you know, Loki is great for its own reasons, but I am waiting for, like, the Ms. Marvel moments where you're like, this is someone I'm actually getting to know for the first time for a long time. So,
I am just like, I just want Tobey Maguire back.
Of course
just in one fucking scene.
You still might get him.
I just want to see him say pizza time or something, and then, like, that's me done for a decade.
Just fling him out. Right. Is there any more thoughts on Loki, or should we bugger off?
I think it's time to pack bags.
Let's get out of here. What music should we have at the end? What have we talked about?
Just a bit of Loki music, or maybe
more,
a bit
more Loki music, because Loki music is actually really good. It's so weird. Oh, what about that mad theremin sound that she had? Ravonna. Let's call the whole thing off. Her office music, the weird theremin that she plays. I want that. Find it, Jesse.
Yes.
I'll have a look. If it's not that, it'll just be some music from Loki. It'll be nice. That is the end of the IGN UK podcast. You can send us feedback at IGN_UK feedback@IGN.com if indeed you have got this far. And, you know, don't send us too many stories about guys getting their balls out in Japan, but if you've got a really good one, you can.
What's your favourite Yakuza encounter? Tell us that.
How many horrible mafioso interactions have you had? Tell us at the IGN UK podcast. And that's it for us. We're going to go. It's lunchtime. I want to eat something. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
If the sun should tumble from the sky, if the sea should suddenly run dry,
have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical, New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.